Roger Williams University is hosting a crisis management seminar on May 3rd at their Providence campus. Crises, whether a natural disaster, cyber attack, or financial instability, can have severe repercussions if not handled properly. This is where crisis management plays a pivotal role. Join Roger Williams MBA students and expert speakers to learn how to prepare for the unexpected. The program is totally free and open to the public. You can register online at rwu.edu/events/crisis-management-symposium.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome into another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. It's Bill Bartholomew here with you as we welcome in investigative filmmaker Cullen Hoback, who is the creator of the wildly popular HBO docuseries Cue Into the Storm, which frankly chronicles, explains, and unearths the QAnon phenomenon that has gripped our nation, at least at some level, right, for the last 3-4 years. And this was such a fascinating docuseries to me, something that I absolutely binge-watched as new episodes were rolled out on HBO. It really is an opportunity to take a look at QAnon from the perspective of the key players in the movement. And throughout the course of the docuseries, Cullen introduces us to a series of characters, Frederick Brennan, who was the creator of 8chan. 8chan, of course, is the image board website where the Q drops were posted, where these messages that were potentially coming from someone super close to Donald Trump with Q-level security clearance. 8chan's where they were being posted. And then Jim and Ron Watkins in particular, who ultimately, basically, of course, it's up to the viewers to decide for themselves, but particularly Ron Watkins ostensibly admits that he is in fact Q. And boy, it just puts into perspective this whole scenario around QAnon, which at one point made its way to the White House. And here in our home state of Rhode Island, we're broadcasting from Providence right now. Anne Armstrong and Alan Gordon, remember them? They ran for governor and attorney general, respectively, in 2018. Well, they're featured in the film. And Cullen just does an unbelievable job from a technical perspective of putting this docuseries together, but then also just from a viewer's perspective, really taking you inside the characters and the mindset that ultimately led to the Q phenomenon, and kind of leaves it open to where this goes from here. And that's something that we get into in this podcast conversation. Where does Q go from here now that it's basically been exposed as to who was behind it? And it's a brand that, if it wasn't already, is certainly toxic at this point, but the tenants of QAnon are something that we may see creep into our politics for years to come. So a fascinating conversation with Cullen Hoback, HBO's Q Into the Storm. You got to check it out. Can't recommend it enough. And, you know, if you're a regular listener to this program, now 300 episodes, nearly 300 episodes in, you know, I'm not someone who, I don't really watch a whole lot of television, certainly not talk about it. And when I do, it's something that I genuinely believe is well worth your time. If you're remotely interested in politics, culture, or just how we got here in this place of a quote-unquote divided America. And this docuseries, it really takes you inside one major component of that, that being the QAnon phenomenon. So stick around. This is a great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Feel free to email me anytime, bill@ripodcast.com. That's bill@ripodcast.com. Or tweet at me at Bill Bartholomew. I'm always curious about your thoughts on the matters at hand here on B-Town. Okay, without further ado, let's get to it. Cullen Hoback, Q Into the Storm, here on B-Town. You know, when I discovered this, it was total binge moment. You know, it was like the type of thing where you're just waiting for the next two episodes to drop. No pun intended with the drops there. But, you know, it was, what really struck me was a couple things. Number one, it's such a well done documentary. It's so, it moves so well. It introduces these critical characters and it takes you on this journey without ever losing you over the course of 6-hour-long episodes. But then also you leave watching this documentary series with a clear understanding of this phenomenon that has largely existed online and YouTube, in some friend of your aunt or something that you're friends with on Facebook or whatever, and just sort of an outer space to an extent, but you are able to get a hold of who the people are and where they're coming from when it comes to this QAnon movement. How long did it take you to make this? I mean, what was the process?
It took me about as long to make this as Q was making drops. Mm-hmm. So about 3 years. Yeah. But I picked it up a little bit into Q. I wasn't there right at the get-go, and I was keeping tabs on it in the first few months, but maybe the first 6 months or so. But it wasn't until Reddit banned QAnon that I picked up a camera, and that's because I'd had a background in digital rights, so I'd made a film before about the erosion of privacy online called Terms and Conditions May Apply. And I've talked about those issues for a number of years. And so when Reddit banned QAnon, it just made me wonder, what was an idea that was so dangerous that it deserved to be banned? And might it have the opposite of its intended effect? Might it have a kind of Streisand effect and make people more interested in it? And might it just be the wrong idea? I mean, might doing that just be, might that be sort of the future of the internet? Was it a canary in the coal mine for where digital free speech was headed? And what would be the effect of that? And what powerful forces would then take advantage of those censorship tools? So, it was really that question that brought me into it in the beginning. And of course, I was curious who the hell was behind this whole thing. And I thought that if I figured out who was behind it, it might bring Q to a logical conclusion.
Sure.
And which is not really possible, right? Like, there is no total conclusion to something like Q. I understand that, but there is a sort of there will be some people who will always believe in it, and it will live on in various ways or splinter into different factions. But I think Q as we know it, I think that is changed. So
yeah, and you sort of, if not completely, pretty darn convincingly reveal who or whom are behind or is behind Q in the course of the film. I mean, it is pretty convincing. Did you find along the way that you did such a good job of role-playing and getting multiple people, multiple key players on board with you, seemingly giving you all this access, all this information? Did anyone at any point say to you, hey, are you out to get me, or are you out to sort of break up this movement? It seemed like for at least 90% of the film, you had everybody in your pocket.
I mean, I was not out there to, that was not my goal. My goal was just to chronicle Q. I would tell people this, and this is, I think you see this represented in the series. Yeah, I was just trying to create a historical document, capture the totality of what was happening from all sides. And so you see, I'm filming with people who wouldn't necessarily talk to each other or would say that they hate each other or in some cases wanted to put each other in prison. I mean, everybody knew that I was filming with their opposition. I wasn't keeping that a secret, nor was I keeping it a secret that I was interested in finding out who was behind Q. Everybody knew that to be the case. So I was just generally interested in understanding why people believed in it. They understood that I didn't necessarily share those beliefs, but I would always try to find some element of common ground. And I think that for a lot of people who believe in QAnon, they were also interested in knowing who was behind it. Of course, they weren't necessarily interested in what the actual answer was, but it depends on the person. But I do think that a lot of those who were following Q did want to know the truth. So gaining access was a process. I started with folks like, Alan Gordon and Ann Armstrong, people who were sort of at the lower end of the information or power hierarchy of Q, and got to know the story around Q better and the kind of mindset and who people were using as their sources of Q-related intel, I guess. And then I would try to talk to those people. Of course, once I got in touch with those who were behind the site where Q posts, which is 8chan, that opened up a lot of doors as well. And the reason that I reached out to the guys at 8chan initially wasn't because I thought they were behind Q. It was just because they ran the website where Q was on, and so if anybody knew who was behind it, I figured it would be those who were closest to the source and actually had the forensic data in their hands.
Yeah. And I certainly want to get into that in just a second. But of course, Alan, we'd be remiss not to touch on Alan Gordon and Ann Armstrong. Familiar to your Rhode Island politicos, maybe people, obviously anyone who watched the film and probably others as well. But, you know, they emerged here in Rhode Island politics anyway, as they were QAnon candidates, but it wasn't the first thing that they put forth as their identity. Of course, it was cannabis legalization that was their main thing, and just sort of this freestyle approach to things. But it took a while before people realized that they were, one, leaned right, two, were a part of the Q movement. What was it that drew you into these characters?
Well, Alan Gordon and Ann Armstrong were two of the first QAnon candidates, if not the first. And there weren't a ton of people who were openly QAnon supporters at that time. There were the QTubers, and there were people who were showing up at rallies, but it was still pretty sparse. I'd filmed with one of the couples who had become almost like national QAnon icons for being, you know, Q'd, and which is referenced by Q in the drops. But Alan Gordon and Ann Armstrong, yeah, I'd seen that they were wearing Q paraphernalia and running on a Q adjacent or fully Q platform. So I reached out and just wanted to spend some time with them, see what they were thinking, and I also wanted to capture what was happening around the midterms, because at that point in time, it was not a guarantee that Q would continue into the future. Maybe Q was just ramping up to the midterms, and it was all just sort of a marketing campaign to try to get out the vote around that time. And then we, in episode two, that's a big plot point. Of course, it's in episode two, right? So it's very early on in the story. They're obviously a very quirky couple. I was fascinated spending time with them to learn that they were, they had a background in science. So you're just wondering, well, how do these two come to be? And you could almost imagine there being an entire documentary about those two. Yeah. Maybe if I was earlier in my career, because I'd made a film about LARPing in the past, and I guess I'm drawn to, characters that find themselves sort of in the fringes of society. But I could easily imagine following those two around. And so I actually had to downplay some of the absurdity around them. we include the bit with them talking about MK Ultra and how he has wires coming out of the back of his head and whatnot. And they sing their Q song. By Q song, I just mean Hey Jude, but Hey Q rendition. And in fact, you can hear a remix of that, or the full version, which they posted in response to that remix on my Twitter feed. So,
yeah, shocking stuff. And it was kind of like I said, for me personally, it was like, oh, this makes sense. They are, based on everything we've learned about Q through the course of just general observation, they make sense as somebody who would be those first candidates out, sort of ground floor, public facing, quirky, convinced that what they're doing is a higher truth and has a higher moral purpose behind it than just, hey, we're running for office on X, Y, and Z positions when it comes to legalization of cannabis or any other platform piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think they also, it makes sense, having talked to you a little bit about them and knowing their mindset, that yeah, they would have been some of the first public facing, but I think they were also smart in the sense that they knew that coming out and being pro Q at that point in time would get them more attention. It might even earn them some more votes. And I think that that's part of why we saw a lot of Q people come out, in the last election cycle, saying that they were in support of Q or believed similar things, because it immediately would get them a digital army of support. So I think Alan Gordon and Ann Armstrong, I know they said that even, that it was helping get more attention, bring more attention to them. So I think it was partially a marketing tool for them, but I think they also did like and believe in many of the ideas around Q.
When it came to the film as a whole, and you seem to spend a lot of time traveling to Southeast Asia, and you know, just this almost seemingly grueling process of whether you were alone or whether you had a crew with you, I'm not sure. I mean, it did seem at times you had somebody with you, but how physically demanding was this project?
Well, it kept me in shape up until the editing portion, and now I'm in the worst shape of my life. But yeah. during the production phase, it was pretty taxing because you're flying. I had to find as many cheap flights as I could and try to get the cameras into the right place at the right time to capture the story when events transpire. But if 8chan is suddenly in the news and you need to fly to the Philippines, it's not like you can just get there within 3 hours. So there was always a little bit of lag between a big news item and trying to be there in person. But because this production was done independently, you know, it was really just myself and my wife just throwing money into it in the form of credit cards and personal loans and air miles. For the most part, it was me shooting solo. I'd have a number of cameras with me. I'd bring a drone, gimbal, and tried to keep the production value as high as possible, feeling like a narrative film. That was always my goal while shooting, was to do setups and give myself as much room in the edit so that I could cut it together like a narrative. And sometimes I would have help. I tried to have one, you know, a set of hands helping me out, particularly in countries that I was less familiar with. So the Philippines, you know, when I was in Japan, I never had any help there. I was just by myself. And I think that also helped with the intimacy. If you have a giant crew of 8 people, or I've heard tell of some of the other productions, especially in the later stages that were chronicling this stuff. Where they would come in with these giant crews. And I think that you don't get to know the individuals as well. And I think part of what you feel in the series, this sort of cat and mouse, is very real. Like, you know, it's just me in the room with the individual on screen. There's no one else there in some instances. In some instances, they might have somebody from their team there. But in terms of physically demanding, I mean, the most physically demanding, of course, was getting Fred out of the Philippines. That stretch, that turnaround, I had to fly to the Philippines. COVID was on my heels. I literally came in on the last flight that was allowed in through Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. We had to get him out of there before the indictment dropped. And then the power was out in my condo the morning of. And
yeah.
been asleep for a few hours and... You know, it's not depicted in the story, but my wife's grandmother died, and there was this tension of like, I had to get the fuck out of here, and then of course, you know, the power is just out in a 26-story building, and I had maybe 150 pounds of gear with me, so that was the peak of my physical experience, I guess, was lugging that down. I know 26 flights don't seem like that much, but they're a lot when you have 120 pounds of gear.
Yeah, so. Undoubtedly. I mean, just loading up a car myself, I mean, it's like as a musician and someone who does some TV stuff, I mean, it's, in any scenario, it's grueling. I can't even imagine. But that moment you're describing, you know, Frederick Brennan, he who created 8chan, ultimately had the falling out with Jim and Ron Watkins, sort of the protagonist-antagonist relationship of the film to a certain extent. You seem to form a relationship with Frederick that was still journalistic and observational, but then also there must have been an emotional attachment there as well that seemed to do the right thing, right and wrong. You had to get him out of the Philippines as soon as you could.
Yeah, I mean, so Fred, of course, had started 8chan, and his rivalry had only grown with the current owner operators, Jim and Ron Watkins. And at that point, that's really it's almost the peak, I guess, of their rivalry, where all positions are essentially lost. They're doing everything to put each other in jail. And Fred, in that instance, the reason that he was potential was going to go to, you know, this indictment had been issued, was because he had sort of the crux of the case against him was that he had called Jim senile on Twitter, which the lawyers were arguing is cyber libel, which in the Philippines, I think it can be up to a 12-year sentence with an 8-year minimum. I believe it's 8. So one of my guiding principles, my guess, when entering this world was to minimize harm. And I'm a big free speech advocate in general. So the idea that someone would end up in prison for something that they said on Twitter was abhorrent to me. Regardless of whether or not, Fred, of course, is a messy character. He doesn't necessarily learn from his mistakes, but that doesn't mean that he deserved to die in a Philippine prison. So, I got on a plane. But I also had some rules when I was doing that as well, which is that, I wasn't going to, he had to buy his own ticket. There were things that he had to do. Like it wasn't just suddenly like me just sort of rescuing him. Right. It was me documenting him getting out of there. I was trying to keep a pretty clear line between the role I was playing in that moment and, but the line blurs because at the same time, I can set up rules like that, but if you've got to get out of there, you got to get out of there. So at a certain point, you do what you have to do. And of course, Fred, because he has brittle bone disease, the smallest fall from his wheelchair could kill him. So he needed physical assistance getting to the States, and that was the main role I played.
It's a pretty dramatic moment in a documentary, that's for sure. And definitely, one of those scenarios that I think you say he doesn't learn from anything, doesn't learn from his mistakes. Hopefully that is a chance for kind of a second go around. Now he seems to be creating his fonts and at least in a better place than he would be if he were jailed in the Philippines. There's no doubt about that.
Certainly. I mean, I really hope that he does. I mean, we all tend to repeat our mistakes, right? it's hard to get out of our, sort of cyclical paths. Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, he had said that once he got to the States, you'll be surprised how quiet I can be, and within seconds of having gotten on the plane, he was already planning his revenge.
Yeah, yeah, it's even in his Twitter bio right now. Jail Ron and Jim. It doesn't say Watkins, but everyone knows what it means. What is to become of the Watkins? I mean, where do they go from here? What's, if Q is sort of in a new place now where it's either dying off or becoming more of an ambiguous phenomenon, what happens to 8Kun and those two fellas?
Right. I mean, I think that what we're seeing is that Q has really contracted, and that Q as a brand is pretty toxic right now. The ideas that attracted people to Q and the ideas that people sort of picked up while following Q, those still remain. Some of them are being absorbed into the main line of the GOP. I think we will see a lot of candidates who are espousing QAnon views. Maybe we'll see a resurgence in the use of the sort of Q brand in the next election cycle. It's possible. But I think what we're seeing in the Telegram groups, these groups are usually less than 100,000 people. There's a handful of them. A lot of those who believe in QAnon have been forced off of the mainstream platforms. So we're not seeing the conversations in the same way we used to, but it's not like those who believe in Q have gone away. And it's not like the fissures that existed that, Q kind of filled for people have gone away either. So even though we're seeing a contraction around Q, I think until we start to address some of the things in society that enabled this, be those actual things in society, you know, in the real world, IRL, right, in real life, or online, which is the underlying technology, the algorithms, and the ways that big tech kind of drive us towards more sensational content and into echo chambers and amplify the worst in us. Until we address some of those things, we're going to see new iterations of Q, or you know, or just a resurgence of the same ideas, just not under necessarily under the banner of Q, or being led by Q, or by or by Ron. Now, Ron is actually kind of filled the Q void a bit for some of the followers. If you checked out his Telegram, He's putting forth a number of his theories there now, after the series aired. He is involved in the Arizona recount that's happening. So he's kind of stepped out of the shadows into this new role in the GOP. Meanwhile, I think a lot of those who follow Q are conflicted about how to feel in relate towards Ron. Some are willing to accept what the documentary shows, which is really, I mean, the documentary is not telling people really what to think. It's just showing them, it's just putting these guys on screen and saying, you know, come to your own conclusions, and providing kind of a mountain of evidence that points to Jim and to Ron, Ron specifically. But what happens to them next? I mean, it's beyond my purview to say whether or not they did anything illegal, but I suspect that the main reason that Ron has come as close to saying he's Q without outright admitting it is because he's afraid of the legal repercussions. Particularly around libel, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And certainly with what happened on January 6th, there's definitely some, if not quite a bit of overlap between the events that took place there and, I don't want to say provocation or suggestion, but this just the existence of QAnon certainly allowed for something like what happened on January 6th at the United States Capitol to come to fruition.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that the 6th doesn't happen without QAnon, mm-hmm. but it also didn't happen because of QAnon. Mm-hmm. And Ron was actively trying to get as many people there on the 6th as possible. You know, he was releasing those Moabs the night of, stoking fury towards Pence, who was supposed to certify the results for the for Biden the next day. So I mean, they were certainly poking the bear and prodding along, and Ron was prodding from across the sea. He wasn't there that day. You know, I was there just documenting Jim and seeing what his reaction to everything there was, and trying to, you know, sort of suss out his own culpability, or what he thought about the role he played in it. And I think that that's what you see captured in that final episode, is what he thought the efforts of 8chan, then 8kun, or his efforts to keep the site online so that Q could post, what it had culminated in. But I think that he didn't really find out what the sort of totality of that until he went back to his hotel room. And then you could see what had really gone on inside the Capitol.
Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Bill Bartholomew, and be sure to join the Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group. How has this film changed your life?
I mean, every film, I sort of map my life and from film to film. I just think about it. I think about it kind of like that. And each one is really a different adventure. I guess the book's sort of still out on how it's changed my life. Certainly, I mean, any time you spend a lot of time with any sort of group of people, they're going to shape your experiences to a degree. I think that it's helped me do a better job of playing a role of kind of a neutral arbiter in situations, figuring out how to go between these sides that really hate each other, especially in a society right now that's so hyperpolarized. And it's given me, I mean, in the same way I was really concerned about the erosion of digital privacy, I'm now very concerned about the erosion of digital speech. And I think that while it may feel comfortable for people right now to not have what they may view as toxic or dissenting views on some of these platforms, that the long tail effect of that is going to be something worse. You know, you've got a lot of people kind of regrouping. They're angry. One thing we know is that the hostility of suppression speeds up the treadmill of extremism. And if you tell people they can't speak about certain things, or they can't organize about certain things, it doesn't make them think that they're wrong. It actually makes them double down in those beliefs often. So I think that a lot of the approaches that we've taken right now online are the wrong approach, and I'm very concerned about Section 230 being repealed as a way of quote unquote dealing with extremism, because it just reminds me so much of what happened after 9/11. You know, we were told after 9/11 you need to give up your privacy in order to stop terrorism, and now it feels like we're being asked to surrender the First Amendment in order to combat extremism. And it's like a sleight of hand, because these tech companies don't want us to look at the thing that's actually the source of a lot of this extremist rhetoric in society, which is their business model. You know, if, for fuck's sake, like if our privacy hadn't been undermined so continuously for the last decade by these companies, if our data hadn't been mined, if thousands of data points on each of us hadn't been collected, turned into psychometric profiles that were then turned back against us to manipulate us with micro-targeted campaigns driving us into echo chambers, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. You know, I think that... But the last thing that Silicon Valley is going to do is say, "Oh, let's enact privacy rights. Like, let's do some of these. Let's make some changes that might affect our business model." No, instead they'll say, "No. The algorithms that led us here, we'll just use more algorithms to solve the problem." You know, as I like to say, algorithms, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems. So, you know, I would say rather than taking away more rights online, we should restore more rights online. You know, see how that goes, and then if that doesn't work, we can try to address the speech itself. But speech is speech, and we should look more closely at these algorithms because that's really what's new in this experiment. You know, a lot of people look, and so does big tech, they look at 8chan or 4chan and some of these image board websites that have grotesque, vile, hateful content on them and say, oh, that's the problem. You know, that's where all this comes from. Well, Q was like a seed that was planted on the chans, but it took algorithms to make it grow. And you know, these chan sites have been around for decades. What's new are the algorithms, and that's really what allowed them to propagate. I mean, for goodness sakes, even the Christchurch shooter. You know, all of those news stories that and this blew me away. I mean, all of those stories around the Christchurch shooter that said, you know, oh, he'd been radicalized on 8chan. That everyone was so quick to jump on the bandwagon that these sites were the source of extremism in society. And in fact, once Christchurch released their nearly 800-page report, the Christchurch Commission said, no, he was radicalized on YouTube. And it's not to say that 8chan doesn't have some culpability in all of this, but it's another sort of sleight of hand here to say, oh, well, if we get rid of a site like 8chan, we've solved the problem. When in fact, the problem, I think, is much deeper, and it's hidden in these algorithms, you know, that are beneath the platforms that we, most of us, use every day.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I think that that's definitely the conversation or the debate or where the attention is going to need to go. Again, that's kind of an apolitical thing. I mean, that's just sort of a human beings type of thing. It vaguely reminds me of Occupy Wall Street in terms of the masses versus a small sector of people controlling the way something else that controls everybody else operates. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out going into this decade and even into the next decade, because if it's not dialed back, it's scary to think about where we'll be 2035, 2040, 2050. Algorithmic control of all of the nuances of our lives. I mean, that just seems horrible.
It's passing the buck. I mean, it's basically saying, all right, well, you don't want to deal with this uncomfortable thing. Well, maybe let AI do it for you.
Yeah.
And I wonder which country will be the first one to use AI judges, and then, you know, have maybe a branch of government that's AI. Probably Japan, I guess, if I had to put money on it. But you know, I think that's kind of the slow creep of taking away our own personal responsibility in outcomes in society and offing it to AI. Most of us already experienced this when you have some sort of a problem with the company and you call up and the rep on the other end of the line is like, I'm sorry, the drop-down menu, the machine won't let me do it. You know, the computer won't allow it. Or you just can't even get to a person.
Yeah.
I think that the world is going to increasingly move in that direction, rather than have humans moderate content, which I think is, moderation is really a key answer to this. We're going to, these tech companies are saying, no, we want to use AI for moderation. We want to use more AI to solve all these problems. And then inevitably it's going to cause more problems. And they'll say, oh, bad AI. Don't worry. We have a better algorithm this time. This will keep kind of being the solution in society, you know, when we try to the sort of the unpleasantness of writing somebody writing a ticket for a parking ticket or something, like, oh, well, you can't argue with a robot. The robot just writes you the parking ticket. It's this slow creep.
Yeah.
And then it's similar to how it worked with digital privacy, where these companies would do some awful thing, like scrape up everybody's home Wi-Fi addresses while Google was driving around creating Google Maps. And then they're like, oops, we're sorry. We totally didn't mean to be grabbing all of that stuff, when, you know, it's almost certainly intentional. And I think that's the same thing with these sort of algorithmic solutions. They know they're not really going to work. They know that it's not really going to solve the problem. But it does help. It does help destroy the competition, because Say Facebook gets a rewrite of Section 230, right? This is the law that basically created the internet. It's what allows comment sections to thrive. It's what allows the internet to be the internet. So if you retune it, so you say, all right, well, you have to at least have algorithms in place that are doing moderation, that are scraping for hateful content or scraping for certain keywords looking for ideas or stories that, for whatever reason, we've deemed to be harmful or incorrect. Those algorithms will very quickly be used, to moderate anything that they want to target. Especially things which are critical of the sites which are using them. And who's going to be able to afford it, right? Like, who can afford those algorithms?
Bingo.
And then when those algorithms screw up, it'll just be the cost of doing business. You know, they'll show up, they'll be dragged in front of Congress again. They'll be like, oops, we're sorry. And it'll just be business as usual. Meanwhile, it'll crush any new startups or competition that are trying to get into the space that maybe can't afford that kind of moderation. So it's just a power grab, I think. And I'm very concerned about any version of repealing or replacing Section 230.
Last question. What's next for you? I mean, that sounds like, you know, the continuation of this thought process in some way, shape, or form. I mean, there's obviously got to be some cooling off period after a project like Q into the Storm, but what's on your mind?
I mean, right now I'm just trying to keep the conversation going, answer questions that the series has brought up for people, do things like this, do things like your show. And I'm figuring out what story I'm going to jump into next. I'm not sure if I want to keep delving in this exact corner of the internet. If I feel there's more story to tell around Q, I will. But for right now, I'm pretty content with the series as a whole. But let's see what happens in the future. We'll see what Ron and Jim and Fred all do. We'll see what some of these other characters who were also mentioned in the series do. Some of these, you know, ex-military outfits. What happens, you know, going into the next election cycle. Yeah, I mean, it was a Herculean effort getting this thing out the door. So Once I feel like I've addressed a lot of these questions, I just hope to let my brain thaw for a couple of weeks. I've got a bunch of books I'd like to read, and I'll probably pick up another investigation after this. But I don't want to make any promises at this point as to what exactly I'll be investigating. So.
Well, you deserve it. You deserve the time off for sure, and. You know, in a period where investigative reporting is no longer, I mean, even on like the local 6 o'clock news, I mean, yeah, somebody might get busted for being like a corrupt local senator and having, you know, some kind of connection to a snack stand, you know, so he can make a couple of bucks at the beach or something like that. But long form investigative reporting is so limited right now in terms of where you can find it. And to be able to contribute something like you did, which no mainstream... Well, I mean, obviously, you eventually formed a partnership with HBO. So as you said earlier, this could be considered mainstream. But from an independent lens, to be able to bring this to the people, what a job, man. Totally inspiring, totally, like, you know, just sets the bar higher for what the independent filmmaker, artist, investigative journalist can do. So my hat's off to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think that the future of journalism is probably in the hands of independent filmmakers and journalists out there who just have an itch and are willing to throw it all into trying to unpack a mystery without knowing if you're going to get the answer or not, because they're. The mainstream outlets at this point don't tend to fund things like that. It's been a long time since Spotlight, right? So anyway, I really appreciate you saying that. And I hope we see more of the sort of long-term approach, which is a challenge as well in a news cycle that guns for immediate clicks, right?
Yeah.
You know, in this project, that was one of the challenges, of course, was like stay out of the news cycle. I barely posted on Twitter, in order to just document for 3 years and not interact, you know, openly in relationship to the story. And I think that would be a challenge for mainstream outlets as well, right? Like if they have people out there who are gathering stuff, but they also want to have, you know, something in their headlines daily. Those two things don't necessarily go well together. And certainly there were lots of things that happened throughout this story that could have been news items at any given point. So, and were, I mean, they were, I just had cameras kind of behind the scenes of while headlines were flashing. But anyway, I really appreciate you saying that. And, I'm grateful for, shows like the one you're doing here and the work that you do as well. So, really appreciate it, man.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
At HealthSource RI for Employers, we provide access to health insurance to more than 1,100 local businesses and nonprofits, and 96% of them renew through us every year. Maybe it's our choice of 19 different health plans, our 10 years of customizing solutions, or our one local team of dedicated experts helping employers find quality health insurance. See how our numbers stack up for you. Learn more at healthsourceri.com/employers.